Good afternoon, everybody. Seems like it's been forever since I've been here. Your luck has run out. Here I am. So, anyway. Thought what I might do today is give I call it a pre-Passover sermon. Hopefully it'll help you to think about as you're meditating in your own private home about Passover and what it means for you. And I want to study it from a bit of the historical backdrop that we find it, as well as the scriptural backdrop that we find it. And I hope that you, when we're done here today, you'll feel like there's the story will maybe make a little more sense to you. We can't cover everything because there's a lot of information. Most of the information I've gotten for this sermon I got from classes when I was at Ambassador College, from Richard Page's class in ancient Israel. Any of you took that class? Well, Mr. Martin said he raised his hand, but he didn't understand it, so I'll help him out this time. I was going to pick on him, but this works pretty good. Well, the problem is, if I pick on him, he gets to speak last, so he always gets the last word. So anyway, I really enjoyed Mr. Page's class. I found it probably one of the best classes I had at Ambassador. And enjoyed it a lot. And then some of the other things that we'll be going through today, I'll sort of acknowledge some of the sources that I'm getting, got some of this information from. And some of it is, I hope you'll find interesting, maybe a little bit insightful. Let's turn to Mark 12 as we start here today. Is that something for me to use? Okay. I'll just tell you to forward it. Let's go ahead and go forward to the first slide there. Just go to Mark 12. And I've got it here on my phone, so we're going to go to Mark, the 12th chapter. Mark, the 12th chapter. And I want to begin here in verse 13. Mark 12 and verse 13. I have a little trouble turning pages because my fingers are getting numb, so I'm a little behind you. Be patient. Mark 12 and verse 13. You'll notice here in the 12th chapter of Mark, the religious leadership has had enough of Christ, and they're trying to find a way to shut him up by entrapping him in his words and hopefully getting him to get himself in trouble. And so, people who are otherwise not very friendly with each other, when they have a common enemy, they kind of pull together and try to get to him and try to get him thrown out of the scene here. Let's go to Mark 12 and we'll see here. Mark 12, and I'm going to begin in verse 13. But they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians. And again, just quickly a little bit of background here. Pharisees, obviously, were your very conservative type folks. Herodians were Jews, but they were very liberal in their approach to religion. They were friendly with the Romans. They benefited from the Roman rule because they got jobs for them, from them. And so you have these two opposites on the religious and, for that matter, political spectrum. People who hate each other normally, but they're going to pull together, you know, your enemy and my enemy is our enemy kind of philosophy. So the Pharisees and the Herodians, who have very different answers that they would provide to this question, they're going to try to catch Christ, and no matter how he answers, they think, they can catch him and get him in trouble. So verse 13, and they said to him, some of the Pharisees and the Herodians, these two different parties, if you will, in order to entrap him in his words, and after coming to him, they said, Master, we know, now this, listen to the hypocrisy here, we know that you are true and that you count no man, you court no man's favor. You know, you're impartial because you do not look at the appearance of men, but you teach the way of God in truth. You know, just probably wanted to make Christ sick because he knew what was going on here. He knew his culture. He understood that these people were lying out of their teeth, but he had to go through this and listen to the answer, listen to the question and answer it. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Should you pay taxes, in other words? Should we give it or should we not give it? But perceiving their hypocrisy, see, he knew the Pharisees were going to say no. So if he says no, the Herodians say, gotcha. Yes, you should. If he says yes, the Herodians say, oh, good. And the Pharisees say, gotcha. So they got him. Then Jesus says to them, knowing about the hypocrisy, verse 15, the middle part of that, why do you tempt me? Why do you test me? Bring me a silver coin so that I may look at it. Then they brought it, and he said to them, whose image and inscription is on the coin? And they said to him, well, Caesar's. And you see that here in front of you. And Jesus answered and said to them, render the things to Caesar, and those things that are God to God. And they were amazed at him. He didn't fall into the trap. He didn't fall into the trap. Now, let's go ahead and go on to the next one. The next slide. The Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him and they had a question for him about the resurrection. Again, hypocrisy upon hypocrisy. They knew, Jesus knew that the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, but they had a question about the resurrection. So they're trying to set him up, saying, Master, Moses wrote for us that if the brother of anyone should die and leave behind a wife, but leave no children, then his brother should take his wife and raise up seed for his brother. Ladies, should we lobby to have that reinstituted? How'd you like to be married to your husband's brother? Don't answer that. Anyway, this was a tradition in there, and that was to preserve the family belongings and so forth. Anyway, that's not for us to look at here today. Verse 20. Now there are seven brothers. The first took a wife and died, leaving no seed. And the second took her and died. Now you could say that she's hard on husbands, but this is a theoretical question. And it's a question which is not genuine anyway. They're trying to capture him, trying to get him, trick him into this answer. And then they move forward. And the seventh had her and left no seed. Last of all, the woman died also. Now then, in the resurrection, when they shall arise, to which of them shall she be wife? For all seven had her as wife. Again, there's other scriptures that he would say they don't believe in the resurrection. You see in this account as well. Verse 18 says, the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him with this question. So that's, again, the hypocrisy is clear. Jesus answered in verse 24, answered and said to them, in asking this, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. Oh, the scriptures. So the Sadducees are going to say, you're going to quote Isaiah, you're going to quote Jeremiah, and they did not consider those books and other Old Testament books to be valid. They didn't consider them to be inspired. Maybe interesting historical books. But they only believed in the first five books that Moses wrote, the Pentateuch, if you will, the law. So they only accepted those books. So we got you. And Jesus is saying here, you don't get it. You just don't get it. I'm going to go here to another translation here in just a second, so I want to be ready. So he's reading here. Jesus answered, verse 24, in asking this question, you do err, not knowing scriptures, nor the power of God. Yeah, I got you. They're going to say, we got you. For when they rise from the dead, neither they may marry nor give it in marriage, but are as angels who are in heaven. But concerning the dead, that they do rise, have you not read in the book of Moses? Well, wait a minute, Moses? They know the writings of Moses. Moses can't possibly have talked about the resurrection. They couldn't see that. So, what are they talking about here? Well, he's got them puzzled. So he says, you don't know the scriptures, and you don't understand a whole lot of things he's telling them. Your own scriptures. But he says, now concerning the dead, have you not considered what Moses is saying here, if you will? So then we're going to come down here to So it says, concerning the dead, verse 26, have you not read in the book of Moses about the burning bush, how God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And they're saying, what? He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. Therefore, you err greatly. And the other says, you don't understand the scriptures, because you even the scriptures you quote as your own, and you don't understand the power of God, and a couple of verses above that. So you really don't get it. So when you read, he's saying to them, it means other things as well, but when you read this verse, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Jesus himself is saying, that verse is telling you from your own scriptures that God is the God of the resurrection. So why are you hypocrites sitting here telling me or asking me about a question about the resurrection when you don't believe it yourself? And yet, let me get you straight. In your verses, the only verses that you consider to be valid would be Moses' writings. Moses speaks of it. And what happens? Verse 27, he is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. Therefore, you greatly err. And one of the scribes who had come unto him after hearing reasoning together and perceiving that he answered well, asked him, which is the great commandment? So again, they're really trying to trip him up in this question. So let's go to the next one. And most of what we'll see here, pictures in, that you'll be seeing along with the scriptures are coming from various, from the New Living Translation, from the King James Translation, from the Corrected English Translation, from all in the King James, the New King James Version, and most of this will be noted as you go through the slides. But the pictures will be coming from the movie the Passion of the Christ. Let's go to the next one. Okay, we already talked about this. They say there is no resurrection. He traps them in their own question. You're a hypocrite. You don't even believe in the resurrection, but I'll show you from your own scriptures that that Moses spoke about the resurrection and knew about it. And we're not going to turn there, but Hebrews 11 talks about Moses and others who will be in the first resurrection. Then we see here in Mark 12, they're now trying to trap him, and we'll pick it up here in Mark 12, verse 28. And one of the scribes who had come up to him after hearing them reason together and perceiving that he answered them well, this guy said, this Jesus fellow, he knows what he's talking about. He's tricky. Which is the first commandment of all? So here, being a scribe, the scribe would often go in the temple and every day quote Deuteronomy, Hear, O Israel, the Lord God is one, or Echad, the Lord God is one. And that is considered the great commandment. Deuteronomy, I think it's 4. Yeah, Deuteronomy 6, 4. I can turn there for a minute. And so Jesus, again, knowing this would be the thing. What is the first and most important commandment? Verse 29. Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Shema. They call it, it means hear or listen. Hear intelligently. Listen intelligently is really what the Hebrew means. Hear, O Israel, our one God or is the Lord God. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. Then he adds next thing here, because most religious folks, they kind of get that, love God with all your heart and everything, but human beings, unless they agree with you, well, you don't have to really love them quite as much. You can gossip about them, you can put them down, you can do whatever you want, because they're not as righteous as you, because they don't agree with you in every form of theology. You know, this is typical how people think. And the second is like this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's no other commandment greater than these. Okay, you can't love God, says James, and hate your neighbor. Okay, so these are the two. So again, who could argue with that? Who could really argue with that? Let's go to the next. Now, in John 18, let's go to John 18. I go through a lot of this material, and I try to keep it in somewhat of a chronological order, but you can't do it all the time. And I'm hoping that as you do your private meditation preparing for the Passover, you know the scriptures. But I'm hoping you know a little bit about the background there. It'll have a little more meat for you, have a little more impact in your life than maybe it's had in the past. That's why I really loved Richard Page's class, because it would just kind of make the Bible jump out at you. Make it, and you'd, oh, that's why it says that. That's why this is done. Excuse me. So now we want to go to John, and I'm going to start in verse 12 of chapter 18, because there's a lot of information here. I'm going to start in verse 11. But Jesus said to Peter, put your sword in the sheath. You know, they're in the garden. Peter cuts the ear off of the high priest's servant. Shall I not drink the cup that my Father has given me? Remember, he'd been praying if there's any way that this cup can pass me, but he knows that he has to drink this cup, if you will. Then the band and the chief priests and the captains and the officers of the Jews took hold of Jesus and bound him. So again, there's a contingent of Roman soldiers here, there's a contingent of temple soldiers here, and some of the high priest servants. And the Romans would bring this here to make sure that this arrest doesn't get out of hand, because again, the Romans were brutal leaders, you just didn't want to get into this kind of problem with them. And they led him away to Annas first. Now, why would they take him, when they arrest him, they take him off to Annas? They call him the Doyen Elder, the elder of the chief priests, and it's a matter of protocol. He has the most experience. He's, I guess you could, in our term, we say semi-retired. Many of us can identify with that. And semi-retired, but out of courtesy, you would take this guy to the old, to the more experienced priest. So he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. So again, Caiaphas is the acting high priest, but Annas was the Dogen, as they call it. Was the more experienced one, but again, protocol would dictate this. For he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who had given counsel to the Jews that it profited for one man to perish than for all the people to perish. Again, Jesus was a hot potato politically. A little more background here. Every year during Passover, the Romans would bring in at least two extra legions, because these people, as far as the Romans were concerned, these people who had their one God religion were a bunch of kooks, nuts, and rattlebrains. And for Pilate to get the assignment of being governor of Judea, to put it in our terms today, Judea would be considered the armpit of the Roman Empire. You didn't want that. That was an assignment that a politician on its way out gets. And so again, when we look through some of the history here, and I got to go quickly for time's sake, when Pilate first came in, one of the things he did was he's got this new assignment, and he's again not the brightest light bulb in the hierarchy of the Roman Empire. And he decides, we've got to show these crazy Jews that they're one God and they're crazy Messiah and all this business. We'll show them who's really leader. So they had their legions that have their different standards. You know, the big, if you've seen movies about Romans, they have these big eagles and other things on top of these big long poles. And then they would have to go right past the temple on their way to where Pilate was going to live. Was living. So this, when this happened, it started a riot, because normally what they would do, the Romans would cover those over with cloth to try and show a little bit of respect for these hot-headed, crazy religious Jews. You know, they're in the armpit, as far as they're concerned, the Roman Empire. Let's cover them over and let's not cause trouble. Well, Pilate was going to show off that he was the man, he was in charge, he's not going to let these crazies tell him what to do. Well, they had a riot and thousands of people were killed. So emails went off to Caesar complaining. And so that's a strike against him. So then he says, look, how can I get on the side of these people? This is leadership that doesn't understand who he's leading, if you will. And he says, well, we'll build an aqueduct for them. And, you know, as most government run projects are, there's huge cost overruns. Right? Huge cost overruns. So what does he do? They'll understand if we go and take money out of the temple treasury to pay for the aqueduct system, since we've run out of money, and these little cost overruns are costing us a lot of money. And it's for their benefit, they're going to like it. So they take money out of the temple treasury, and guess what happens? Another bloody riot. More emails go in to Caesar. Okay, so as we go through this story, remember these things, and when you think about it, here you have Pilate with this history, and now they bring him this Jesus guy who claims to be a Messiah. Oh boy, what's this about? He hates the Jews anyway. He's not in Galilee all the time. He only comes back when he has to, like for the Roman, for the Passover and for other things. He doesn't want to be involved with these people. They're nuts as far as he's concerned. And he has no respect for them. But now he's been burned. You don't get burned too many times before Caesar decides, you know, you need a vacation in Siberia somewhere forever. 6 feet under. I mean, it's just a cruel form of government. Very cruel. So now they bring Jesus to him. And again, we'll get into this just a little bit. And you'll recall, he examines Christ, and he comes and he says to the chief priests and the others, I don't see anything wrong with this guy. He's an innocent man. Why do you want him dead? And you'll see it as we go through here. I hope with this little background you understand why he was so reticent, I guess you might say. He was so hesitant to have anything to do with this Jewish guy who claimed to be the king of the Jews, who claimed to be the son of God, whatever all that means. He doesn't understand all this stuff. And here are these crazy hypocritical leaders from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And what are they up to? You know, a crooked politician knows a crooked politician. And that's exactly what you see here. So anyway, so they went to the chief and high priest, and then we'll come down here. We're going to stay here in 18. Let's just pick it up here, verse 28. John 18, verse 28. Now when he led Jesus from Caiaphas to the judgment hall, and it was early, but they did not go into the judgment hall. Why? So that they would not be defiled. Who are these Sadducees and some of them, and as I said, Pharisees, and we're still in, I think I got the guys mixed up there. We're in John 18. So, but they did not go to the judgment, because Jesus has now been arrested. He's now going through the trial with Pilate. Pilate's trying to get him off. And they come out, and there's almost a riot breakout. And again, then now Pilate's wife comes and says, in this culture, dreams have a lot of meaning. The gods would communicate with you through dreams. And she says, I've had a dream, and this says, don't have anything to do with this honest man, this innocent man. Great. Then later on, for time's sake, just have to refer to some of it. He also says here, Jesus says, if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight. But my kingdom is not of this world. And he's saying, so your kingdom is a spiritual kingdom? Yeah. I'm paraphrasing here. And now he's really in a fix. Because they believe in many gods, and they actually believed, like in Thessalonica and other places, there was a belief that the gods would come down and visit you from time to time, and then they would pass judgment on you depending on how well you treated them. And so he's thinking, ay, 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 well, what do I do? Because if he really is from the gods, whoever that the gods it may be, what am I supposed to do here? And my wife's had this dream, and everybody knows dreams are really important to, you know, in that culture. And it says, leave him alone. I know these politicians, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, I know they're lying. They know they're lying. What am I supposed to do? Again, with this history, I think you can understand why he's so hesitant to do anything. Because he's been burned twice, burned me three times. He says, boy, shame on him. So again, for time's sake, I'll just, you realize the story, hopefully, as you go over your private study. That's why, you remember he went through the theatrics of washing his hands? He says, you want to kill him? You kill him. Remember, he washed his hands, kind of the very theatric kind of thing. He's saying, when this thing comes and bounces back in my face, and you guys send more emails off to Caesar, and you say, he killed our king. It's in the files, it's on the, you know, records here, that I didn't find anything wrong with him, and that you wanted him dead, I washed my hands of all this, and that's why he did that. It's again, very theatric, but really trying to cover himself as a politician. He did not want these people to come back and accuse him of this. And even, again, for time's sake, remember Judas came back and he said, threw the 30 pieces of silver back on the floor. And he says, you know, now I realize you're going to kill him. And he didn't really think, I think Judas's theory, but Judas may have just wanted to scare Christ into becoming more politically active in overthrowing the government of the Romans. And again, that's a theory. But then when he realized that Jesus was going to be killed, he says, no, I've betrayed innocent blood. And it's interesting, you see the Pharisees and the Sadducees there in the temple, they were saying, they threw the money on the temple, now they're going to quote their religious rules again. Yeah, we're going to have this guy murdered, and they admit that he's innocent. But it's better for one guy to die than all of us, because the Romans are going to get mad at all of us and kill us all. Which eventually happened in 70 AD. So, I got ahead of myself there. So, what was I saying again? Oh, 30 pieces of silver. I get going too fast. Judas threw the pieces of silver on the ground, and the Pharisees said, we can't use this in the temple treasury, because the scripture says you can't use the money for when you shed innocent blood. Hello? They knew he was innocent, but they had to get rid of their political foe, which is a danger to them. And again, just a little more, I'm not going to turn to all the scriptures here. Go ahead and just go to the next slide here, or whatever they call these things. Mark 14. Let's go back to Mark 14. Let's see, we started at 2. I'll give you 5 minutes. How's that? Yeah, I hate to go over. Let's see. Mark 14. We would sit in a class with Dr. Page, and the time would go by so fast. I'd think, oh, wow, you know, all of this history and things. And he would come, at least when I was there, he would come with a different Bible every day, not to show off. I didn't even know about it until a long time later. He would come up with a different Bible every class because he didn't want to get lazy and remember about where on whatever page I do that. I'd rather get the lazy part. Okay, it's usually this about down here in this area of this verse, of this chapter. He would bring different translations, different Bibles, so that he wouldn't let himself be get lazy. He had multiple degrees before he was 20 years old. And so anyway, really, he knew his stuff. He was Jewish by ancestry and raised in a Jewish family. So when he sort of just fit right into that scene when he became a believing Christian, he sort of fit right into that and could make that transition for us. Okay, Mark 14. And I'm going to start here in verse 60. There's a lot of information. We'll just go here to verse 60 and pick up. Now the high priest stood up, and this is what they said. Stood up in the center and questioned Jesus, saying, have you nothing to say to answer what these are testifying against you? They bring all kinds of false charges against him. But he remained silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest questioned him and said, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And you notice it's capitalized there. It's a euphemism. Again, at that time, at least publicly, the Pharisees and the priests did not want to use God's name publicly. That's another whole sermon, but they didn't want to use his name publicly, so they'd use a euphemism so that they couldn't be accused of blaspheming against God's name by using God's name. And Jesus says, I am. Ooh, that harkens back to Exodus, doesn't it? Moses said, well, who do I don't know who you are, by the way. So who, when the children of Israel ask who you are, what should I say? And he says, well, tell them I am sent you. So this was very deliberate. Jesus says, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven. Jesus isn't saying, you're going to see me at the right hand of God Almighty, see, coming with power. No, he says here, he's using a euphemism, knowing, this is not, he knows it's not wrong to say God's name, but he knows the culture and he knows this tradition and he knows they're trying to trap him. So he uses the euphemisms for God. And he says, I am. Now, this is really what just freaked out the high priest, as we'll see here in a minute. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power. That's a euphemism for God. And coming with the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest ripped his own garments and said, what further need have we of these witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. And what is the verdict? So, you see, that's what we're talking about. Let's go on to the next one here. A little more theatrics here, where they... We'll talk here real quickly about what is a euphemism. Many times we think of euphemism as a nice way to cuss, but that's more our culture today. But Webster's Dictionary says a euphemism is a mild or indirect word or expression substituted for one considered to be too harsh or too blunt. So they're using substitution words. Okay, substitution words. The right hand of power, we talked about that. The Son of Man, the Son of the Blessed, and also in these other ways. So he's knowing how he should answer to evade these unnecessary accusations of being guilty of blasphemy. But when he said, I am, that's what freaked out the high priest, knowing that it's referring back to the time of Moses and to the writings of Moses. And you'll see that in certain and different places here as you go through this account. So he rips his clothes. So let's go to the next. Isn't that dramatic? Again, and when you rip your garments, woe is me, I'm so righteous, and I'm going to rip my clothes, and blah, blah, blah. He hasn't blasphemed at all. And, of course, using a euphemism was not a blasphemy. But when he said, I am, remember, God told Moses, I am that I am. You tell them that I am sent you. That's what just freaked out. And that was the way that they could make that charge against him. Well, let's go to the next one. Now, this is from the pictures from the movie The Passion of the Christ. That's why I sort of told you where I'm getting that. There's some discussion. Was Christ flogged once and then scourged once? It's not really a huge big deal. But there seems to be some feeling that Christ would have been first flogged with something akin to a rubber type of mallet kind of thing. And what it would do is, and if this is how it happened, there's a lot of debate between scholars, and it's not that big a deal for our purposes. We know that this is tame, by the way. This was nothing compared to what he looked like. Because it says his visage was so marred that he didn't even look human anymore. By the time they got done beating him, the skin was ripped off. You couldn't even hardly tell he was a human anymore. So, anyway, it's probably one of the most realistic. If you've ever seen that movie, the guy who's whipping him, and I think it's a good depiction, the man is in a demonic rage, trying to just enjoy ripping this man's body apart. And you see they just about beat him to death. And most men never survived floggings. It was too brutal to the body. But it's believed, as a possibility anyway, that at one point, the first thing that Pilate did, because Pilate's trying to get Jesus off here, and yet he doesn't want to get the Jews upset with him, and yet they are already upset, and they want blood, they want his blood, da, da, da. So some of you read some of these accounts in the Gospels, the first thing he may have been was scourged or chastised. Some of the words are chastised. It may have been like a rubber mallet, kind of rubber, long piece of rubber, and it would hit the body all over. It would rupture the blood vessels under the skin, but it wouldn't break the skin. So it would rupture the blood vessels underneath the skin, and it would mar the person to such a point that they would just be hideous to look at. Okay? And remember when Mary was, they went to the open tomb and Jesus had already been raised, and she thought she was talking to the gardener because God hadn't opened her mind yet to understand she's actually talking to the resurrected Christ, because he was appearing as this terribly marred figure. Remember, says if thought he was a gardener, why would he think he's a gardener? Because people who survive that kind of beating and flogging, as well as the chastisement, they would be so permanently scarred, they couldn't get a job anywhere except in a graveyard where they could bury the dead. And so it made sense that Mary would look and say, "Oh, you're the gardener. Well, tell me where they put my Lord. Tell me where they buried him." And then, you know, and finally he said, you know, "Mary," it must have been a certain phrase. And of course, God opened her mind to understand it. So anyway, so it may be that he was first beaten like this with the rubber mallets, and it would rupture the blood vessels under the skin. And then, either way, it still works out in the story flow. Pilate brought him up before the crowd, and he says this word several times in John. Again, I won't turn there for time's sake. It says, "Behold the man." And in the Greek, the word "behold" means it's supposed to show a shock. To hopefully, you wanted this? Well, look what you've made me do to him. And here's this terribly marred human being. Isn't this enough? Is this to satisfy your bloodlust? Is this enough? Here's this man who's now beaten, at least the first steps of being beaten beyond recognition. Isn't this enough? Behold the man. He says it three times. I believe it's in the Gospel of John. Behold the man. And again, the Greek is saying it's an idea of it should shock you. Isn't this horrible? That's how we'd say it. Look what you've made me do to this poor creature. Let him go. You maybe can get a job in a graveyard where the dead don't mind what he looks like. Now, that could be he went through that, or and then later on with the scourging. But the scourging was such a terrible experience that most men didn't survive it. Ladies, they didn't scourge. Even in the Roman Empire, they did not scourge women. They did all kinds of other terrible things, but they did not do it to women. So this was this is tame, but at least when you get a look at it. Let's go to the next. So you see here, again, for time's sake, you see these verses here. They led Jesus away from Caiaphas to the hall of judgment, and early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall. The Pharisees, which could mean Pharisees and the zealots. Why? Well, because it says, again, for time's sake, it says, because they wanted to eat the Passover. You go, wait a minute. Passover? Jesus already had the Passover meal. Well, the question is, where does the Passover start, on the early of the 14th or late on the 14th? Goes back thousands of years. And that's been a big debate in the Church of God in our lifetimes. Most of the Pharisees kept the first part of the 14th of the first month of the year. Jesus did, so that's pretty good for me. As he did that, it's good enough for me. But it says the Sadducees and the Pharisees, they didn't go into this hall of judgment because they wanted to eat at the Passover, which they did it 24 hours later. They would do it 24 hours later. So that old argument is thousands of years old. And it says Jesus kept it early on the 14th. And that's when we do. Good enough. Now let's move on to the next. And we know that he was beaten. So I thought that was pretty dramatic. Anyway, I talked about this is the gospel account with a lot of history and very quickly done of the murder of Christ, because it was the murder of an innocent man. And again, go through in your own pre-Passover examination of yourself. Go over these verses, thinking about the things that we've talked about. And you can find a lot of this in various history books. I've written down, it's on YouTube. You could write down, that's the actual link, but I don't think you want to try to write that all down. But you could go to YouTube, type in Pilate confronts Jesus, or Jesus before Pilate, whatever. And then look for, there's a lot of different videos on it, but the one you're looking for is one on done by the History Channel. Now, we don't endorse everything that's in that, but it gives you a lot of good information about how historians read it. Now, again, there's some wrong information in there, but I think it might help you to get a sort of a sense of what you, how historians look at it. Quickly, they said, well, the Pilate of the Bible is not the Pilate of history. That's crazy. The Pilate of history, when you understand his history from a historical perspective, it makes a whole perfect sense. You see the Pilate of the Scripture, that I try to show you, that he was terrified of making yet another mistake and get in trouble with the Romans again. He was terrified of that. They missed that in that video. But still, you get a lot of interesting facts and things with that. So, again, I hope that you will, as you prepare for the Passover, you'll be thinking about some of these things that we've talked about and realize there is a lot of history that you can substantiate through your own study about these events from a historical perspective. In that, wow, when you read it from a spiritual perspective, yes. But you also can have a lot of confidence that the spiritual perspective is even added for us and even enhanced for us when you can see through history it is supported. So I'm hoping that will be helpful to you as you do your pre-Passover preparation.